If you look at the raw numbers from the publishing industry recently, you're going to see a phenomenon that, frankly, defies normal market logic.
Oh, absolutely. The sheer volume is staggering.
Right. I mean, we're talking about a system that drove roughly 51 million units in US print sales in just a single year. And then there's the specific subgenre, romantasy.
Yeah, which is just dominating right now.
Completely dominating. It pushed over $610 million in revenue. And, you know, when you see numbers like that, the immediate reaction is usually a cultural one. You ask, well, what is it about the zeitgeist that makes these explicit romance novels so popular right now?
Which, I mean, that is the standard literary question. It kind of assumes we're dealing with a trend in taste or maybe a shift in cultural values.
Yeah, but the sources we're unpacking today, a pair of incredibly detailed analytical documents, they suggest that asking about cultural taste is, well, it's entirely the wrong approach.
It really is.
They argue that to understand this massive volume of consumption, we basically have to stop looking at these books as literature and start looking at them as highly calibrated, highly engineered behavioral delivery systems. The argument here is that the modern explicit romance novel and its audiobook counterpart is functioning as an immersion engine.
An immersion engine designed from the ground up to hack human neurochemistry.
Yes. Exactly. And engineered is not an overstatement
No,
here.
not at all. The evidence laid out in these documents, it spans the stated, deliberate intent of the publishers themselves, the psychology of narrative transportation, the science of parasocial attachment, and this is the wild part, the hard neurobiology of reward and bonding.
Right.
So we are looking at a very specific mechanism. It operates in four distinct stages to manufacture a relationship that your brain genuinely registers as real.
Okay, let's unpack this because I want to get straight into the architecture of this thing. Because the first stage, it completely upended how I think about storytelling in general.
It really flips it on its head.
Yeah, it really does. So the sources call this first stage the blueprint or the scaffolding. And it starts with a radical reframing of what plot actually is. I mean, if I pick up a murder mystery or like a science fiction epic, I assume the plot is the point.
Right, the events are the reason you're reading it.
Exactly. But the publishing industry behind these explicit romance genres, they openly admit that the plot is not the end goal.
No, it's structural.
Yeah.
If you look at the craft literature, like the instructional guides written for authors by major industry authorities, they literally invert the traditional hierarchy of narrative.
Give me an example of it, because that sounds wild.
We'll take Jericho Writers, for instance. They're a massive author services company, and they state this dynamic very plainly. They point out that in standard, traditional romance novels, the physical intimacy and the sex scenes revolve around the plot.
Okay.
The plot is the main driver. But in explicit or erotic fiction, the plot revolves around the sex scenes. They tell the writer that their actual job is, essentially, to figure out how to thread each explicit scene together with a plausible storyline.
Thread them together. You know, that makes the narrative sound like a string, and the intimate scenes are the beads.
That's a great way to look at it.
And the string only exists to hold the beads in place.
Yeah, and you see this echoed by the authors themselves, too. Christian Baines is cited in the sources, stating, just bluntly, that the primary purpose of this genre is to turn the reader on. The plot is just a vehicle.
It exists to get you from one explicit scene to the next.
Exactly. There's actually a really fascinating defense of this from Tina Engler.
Oh, she founded Alora's Cave, right?
Yes, one of the major pioneering digital erotic romance publishers. So she was defending the use of the standard romance framework, you know,
Yeah.
the rise in conflict, the misunderstandings, the guaranteed happy ending. She called it a necessary container.
A container. Interesting.
Yeah. Her argument was that leaving the plot out of an erotic novel is like leaving the plot of the murder mystery out of the mystery. If you do that, it just becomes a clinical description of an event.
Right, it reads like a medical textbook or something.
Exactly.
Okay.
But the DIY MFA guide takes this a step further. They use a very specific phrase. They call it a scaffolding of tension and release.
Scaffolding, that word scaffolding, that feels like the key to understanding the entire mechanism.
It is, because think about what a scaffold does. It holds things up, sure, but more importantly, it creates space. We have to look at the underlying psychology here to understand why the industry relies on this specific structure. It is entirely about the psychology of delay.
Delay, like making you wait for it.
Precisely. The golden rule taught in every single romance writing workshop is that anticipation is the most powerful aphrodisiac.
Oh, wow.
So the plot, the forced proximity where they have to share a single bed, the enemies to lovers dynamic where they claim to hate each other, the constant interruptions, all of that exists solely to stretch the interval between the initial spark of desire and the eventual release.
So the plot is essentially a manufactured waiting room. It's the chase.
It is the architecture of the chase. Because the interval, that delay, that is where the reward chemistry is actually generated in the brain.
Wait, really?
Yeah. If an author just jumps straight to the consummation on page 2, the neurochemical machine doesn't activate. The scaffolding forces a delay of gratification specifically to intensify the eventual neurochemical payoff.
Man, what strikes me about this is how industrialized this timing logic has become. Like, we aren't just talking about individual authors organically discovering pacing in their writing rooms.
No, this is highly systematized.
Right. The sources detail how this delay mechanism is a deliberate corporate strategy. Editors at major publishing houses are literally acquiring books based on prepackaged tropes that are tailored for highly specific, segmented audiences on platforms like TikTok.
Yeah, the trope is basically the specific flavor of the scaffolding. Libby McGuire, she's a senior vice president and publisher at Atria. She talked about the modern acquisition process.
What'd she say?
She mentioned reading a submission and immediately recognizing the specific structural beats. You're thinking, we know this reader. We know exactly where to find them on TikTok.
So they aren't buying a unique literary voice at all?
Not really, no. They are buying a perfectly executed structural blueprint.
Oh, right. And Liz Pelletier from Entangled Publishing, they're the house behind that absolute juggernaut fourth wing. She operates on this exact same model. The sources note they actually use test marketing and tune materials based on engagement before release.
It's completely trope-forward acquisition.
Yeah, it reduces the whole concept of a novel to a bundle of pre-sold reward triggers. It's like a recipe, you know, like we need an enemies to lovers dynamic plus a forced proximity situation plus a guaranteed high heat level.
They specify the narrative scaffolding like a product manager outlining requirements for a new piece of software.
And that software analogy is incredibly apt, especially when we look at the ultimate evolution of this scaffolding. I'm talking about serialized paper chapter platforms, apps like Galatea and Radish.
Well, this is where it gets really dark.
Right. This is where the psychological delay of the plot fuses directly with a financial transaction. The industry analysis in our sources points out that the core mechanic of these apps, this cliffhanger unlock loop, is borrowed directly from mobile gaming.
Yeah, and the mechanics are ruthless.
I was reading through the user experiences on those apps in the deep dive sources, and it's wild. You download the app, you get a free opening chapter to get hooked into the narrative, right?
Standard freemium model.
Exactly. So the scaffolding sets up the anticipation. And then, right at the peak of the tension boom, a cliffhanger and a coin unlock screen drops down.
It's right in the middle of the scene.
Yes. You are presented with a choice. You can either wait 20 hours to see what happens, or you can pay a microtransaction to keep reading immediately.
Which turns the emotional tension into a literal monetization lever. The narrative suspense is held hostage.
Hostage is the perfect word.
There is a quote in the sources from a Galatea user who was waiting that 20-hour period for a single chapter, and they literally described the sensation as, it's killing me.
Oh.
Another reader on Radish called it an unhealthy addiction and admitted they were actually going broke because they physically could not stop reading.
Because fractionalizing the story obscures the total cost, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you walked into a bookstore and saw a paperback romance novel priced at $120, you'd laugh and walk out.
Of course you would.
But when it's sub-dollar unlocks and they're doled out exactly at the peak of your neurological anticipation, you end up paying that $120 without even realizing it.
The plot is no longer just a delay device for arousal or emotional satisfaction. It is quite literally a delay device for payment.
Wait, so you're saying the plot of these massive bestsellers is essentially just a highly monetized waiting room? Like, it's like a slot machine.
A slot machine.
Yeah, think about it. The spinning wheels of a slot machine, that's the plot. The flashing cherries and lemons are the tropes. The machine is just delaying the payout to keep you sitting at the stool, completely mesmerized.
That is exactly what it is. And the throughput of this system is staggering. To give you a sense of the scale, the data shows that almost half of all avid romance readers consume at least one novel per week.
A week?
Some consume far more. That level of volume is not a casual, rainy Sunday hobby. That is a highly optimized system tuned for rapid, high-frequency consumption. The scaffolding is designed to be easily digestible, so you can immediately move on to the next one.
Okay, so that establishes stage one. The plot is the timing device, it's the scaffolding, the spinning wheels. But here's the thing about a slot machine. Watching someone else play it doesn't give you the same thrill.
No, you have to be in the seat.
Right. To get the chemical hit, you have to be the one pulling the lever. You have to feel like you are inside the experience. Which brings us to stage two of the immersion engine. The sources call this hijacking the eye, or first-person erasure.
Yeah, because the scaffolding alone isn't enough. If the text simply presents a character experiencing anticipation, the reader is just an observer.
And the neurochemical response is muted.
Exactly. For the engine to work at full capacity, the distance between the reader and the protagonist must be completely collapsed. The anticipation must be lived, not watched.
Lived, not watched.
And the primary structural tool for this is grammatical. It's the first person voice.
It's fascinating that such a complex psychological state hinges on a single pronoun, just the word I. But the publishers, they know exactly what they're doing. Harlequin, which is, I mean, synonymous with the genre.
Well, absolutely.
They literally teach this as a mandatory craft technique in their writing guidelines. They instruct authors to use first-person perspective to create instant intimacy with your readers.
Readzy, the editorial platform, they analyze this effect too. They note that first-person produces this immediate sensation that the story is being whispered directly to you by a confidant.
Like a secret.
Yeah. But it's when you pair that first-person I with the present tense that the real hijacking occurs.
Right. The difference between I walked into the room and I walk into the room.
Exactly. Stacey Gold, an author cited in the sources, she points out that present tense makes it feel like you are living the events yourself in real time, right alongside the character.
So to understand why this is so effective, we have to look at media psychology, right? There are two deeply established mechanisms at play here. Narrative transportation and identification.
Yes.
Let's break those down. What exactly is narrative transportation beyond just, you know, getting lost in a good book?
Well, it's an actual measurable cognitive state. Green and Brock, they are foundational researchers in this area. They define narrative transportation as a total absorption into a story.
Total absorption.
Yeah, it's an integrative melding of your attention, your emotional processing, and your visual imagery. When you are highly transported, you actually produce a measurable detachment from your physical reality.
Wait, like you literally stop feeling the real world.
Yes. Your brain stops processing the feeling of the chair you are sitting on or the ambient noise of the room. And crucially, transported readers become highly susceptible to adopting the beliefs and emotional states presented in the story.
Because their critical real-world context has been temporarily suspended.
Exactly. They lose their defensive armor.
And that makes the second mechanism possible, right? Identification.
Right. Cohen defines identification as the process where an audience member assumes the identity, the goals, and the perspective of a character to such an extreme degree that the psychological boundary between self and other dissolves.
The boundary dissolves. Wow.
You are no longer evaluating the character's choices. You are experiencing their impulses as your own. And linguistic analysis confirms that the first-person pronoun I is the most direct grammatical trigger to initiate this fusion. It signals an internal, subjective perspective.
And when you add present tense to that I, it locks the fusion in place. Because if it's past tense, like, I walked into the room and saw the villain, the narrator already knows they survived to tell the tale.
Right, there's a subtle distance there.
But in present tense, I walk into the room, the narrator is just as ignorant of the next 5 seconds of the future as the reader is. The reader and the protagonist are fused together in a state of simultaneous suspense.
Which is why the publishing industry has pushed this psychology to its absolute extreme with a concept known as the blank slate protagonist.
Now, this part of the deep dive, this completely blew my mind because it recontextualizes characters that have been heavily criticized for years.
Oh, the backlash has been huge.
Huge. Everyone knows Bella Swan from the Twilight series. For years, literary critics just tore that character apart for having no personality, no distinct physical description, no real driving ambitions outside of the romance.
Right.
But the sources document that this was not a failure of writing. She was engineered as a near empty vessel. She was deliberately designed as a blank slate so that millions of different readers could project themselves into her place without any cognitive friction.
Exactly. Because if the protagonist has highly specific, rigid traits, say she is a brilliant, sarcastic, 6-foot-tall concert pianist with a very specific traumatic backstory, the average reader will struggle to achieve total identification.
It's too specific.
The specific traits act as friction. They constantly remind the reader, I am not this person.
But if she's just, you know, a slightly clumsy girl who moved to a new town, anyone can slip into that skin.
Anyone. And that template has proven to be incredibly potent. Look at the lineage. 50 Shades of Grey originally began as Twilight fan fiction.
Right. I always forget that.
The protagonist, Anastasia Steele, she inherited that exact same blank slate vacancy from Bella Swan. She is essentially an empty avatar. And that series sold over 150 million copies worldwide.
150 million copies for a character with almost no defining characteristics. That is wild.
And the fanfiction community, which is where a massive amount of modern romantasy authors cut their teeth, they formalize this even more. They have a convention known as YN, or Your Name, Reader Insert Fiction.
Oh, where the story literally uses the placeholder YN, so your brain just inserts your own name into the text.
Yes. The writing guides explicitly instruct authors to make the protagonist as vague and general as possible, so anyone reading can imagine it's actually them. We have to completely discard the idea that minimal character description is bad writing.
Right.
Within the context of the immersion engine, it is a highly optimized feature.
So lack of character description isn't bad writing, it's an engineered vacancy. I was trying to think of a way to visualize this, and it's like an empty electrical socket.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, the author builds a character-shaped hole in the narrative that is specifically sized and shaped for you, the listener, to step into. And once you plug yourself into that socket, the emotional current of the story flows directly into your nervous system without any resistance.
That analogy holds up perfectly when you look at how the market now enforces this design. First-person, present-tense, blank-slate narration has become the overwhelming standard in the genre.
They won't accept anything else.
No, and readers actively police it. There's a very telling anecdote in a Slate article cited in our sources. A reader was at an author's signing event and flat-out told the author, "I won't read this book of yours because it's in third person."
Just right to their face.
Right to their face.
Yeah.
Another reader in that same article explained the appeal of the engine flawlessly. It said, "When I read first person, I'm almost like, that's me. That's me in the book.
That's me in the book." The erasure of the reader's distinct self is complete. They have fully inhabited the avatar.
And achieving that fusion is the necessary prerequisite for stage three. Because think about what happens when you combine stage one and stage two.
Okay.
You have a narrative scaffolding designed to endlessly delay and heighten emotional anticipation. And you have a grammatical structure that forces you to experience that anticipation as if it is happening to you.
Right.
When you live through these highly charged, intimate experiences repeatedly over hundreds of pages from inside the avatar's head, your brain begins to process the data in a very specific way. It begins to form a bond.
Stage three of the engine, the fake relationship or parasocial bonding.
The term parasocial interaction was coined back in 1956 by Horton and Vohl. They used it to describe the phenomena of intimacy at a distance that people were developing with television personalities and radio hosts.
Even though the host has no idea who you are.
Exactly. Even though the relationship is entirely one-sided, the viewer feels a genuine sense of connection. Decades of subsequent research have shown that these parasocial bonds function remarkably similarly to real relationships. They strengthen with repeated exposure, and they serve to reduce psychological uncertainty.
Which perfectly explains why these serialized books and massive romanticy series are so long.
Yes.
It's not just about providing more plot. It's about providing more hours of exposure to deepen the parasocial bond.
Yeah.
You end up spending more time with this fictional partner than you do with most of your real-world friends.
And it runs on the fundamental architecture of human attachment. Research by Rain and Marr looked at applying adult attachment theory to how we interact with fiction.
And what did they find?
They found that fictional characters offer a simulation of interpersonal intimacy, but with zero risk of rejection.
Zero risk.
Zero. In psychological terms, they function as an ideal secure base. A fictional partner is always available when you open the book. Their emotional arcs are ultimately predictable, and they cannot abandon you.
It's the ultimate safe bet for intimacy. You get all the warmth of belonging without any of the vulnerability or the messiness of a real human being who might, you know, wake up in a bad mood or text their ex.
Exactly.
But the part of this deep dive that I found truly staggering, the part that moves this from a neat psychological theory to hard biological reality, is the fMRI study.
Broom and Wagner.
Yeah.
This study is crucial for understanding the sheer power of the immersion engine.
Walk us through it.
They used functional MRI to observe the brain activity of lonely individuals while they thought about different categories of people. They found that when these individuals thought about their favorite fictional characters, the brain processed them using the exact same social cognition circuitry that it uses for real people. Specifically, an area called the temporoparietal junction.
Okay, let's pause and unpack that. What exactly does the temporoparietal junction do in a normal, everyday context?
The temporoparietal junction, or TPJ, is heavily involved in what we call theory of mind. It's the part of your brain that allows you to understand that other people have their own thoughts, feelings, and perspectives that are different from yours.
So like reading a room.
Exactly. When you look at a friend's face and realize they are secretly upset even though they are smiling, your TPJ is doing that computational work. It is the core hardware of human empathy and social processing.
And Broom and Wagner found that this exact same piece of hardware is lighting up for fictional characters.
Yes. The brain does not appear to have a fiction toggle when it comes to social processing. It doesn't route fictional characters to a separate imaginary friends folder. It simply files them under people.
That is profound. Because if the brain is processing them as real people, then the emotions the reader is feeling aren't just a simulation.
No, social surrogacy research backs this up entirely. Favored media and favored characters can genuinely supply the psychological experience of belonging.
Wow.
They can buffer a person against self-esteem threats or feelings of rejection in the real world. For the reader immersed in stage three of this engine, the fictional partner isn't just a substitute for connection. Neurologically speaking, it is connection.
And you can see this neurological reality bleeding out into the culture. I mean, the language readers use is so revealing. People talk entirely unironically about their book boyfriends or their book husbands.
Yes.
There is a widely recognized phenomenon called a book hangover. Have you heard of this?
I have. It's that distinct withdrawal state you enter after you finish a massive series.
Exactly. You feel lethargic. You can't focus. You feel a sense of loss. And you immediately start scouring the internet trying to find a replacement book that has the exact same trope so you can get the feeling back.
That is the behavioral signature of a disrupted attachment bond.
There was a survey by Thrift Books that looked at 2,000 avid romance readers. The results were wild.
Oh, the statistics on this are fascinating.
Yeah, a majority of the respondents admitted that reading these books made them significantly more selective about their real-world partners. And over 40% explicitly said they measure their real-life partner against a literary hero.
Which is an impossible standard for a real human to meet.
Completely impossible.
The literary hero represents a curated standard of perfect emotional availability, physical perfection, and unwavering devotion, all delivered without the messy risks, the compromises, or the mundane boredom of real-world relationships.
Right.
When a reader finishes a book, the subsequent withdrawal and the frantic replacement-seeking behaviors are classic markers of a dependency cycle.
But let me play devil's advocate for a second, because this is where my brain gets stuck. If we connect this to the bigger picture and zoom out, readers know these characters are fake. Consciously, they know it is just ink on a page or pixels on a screen. No one actually thinks a 500-year-old fairy warrior is going to walk through their front door. So why does a book hangover actually manifest in the body as a feeling of real-life grief? Like, why does it feel like a real breakup?
Because your conscious mind and your primitive social cognition circuitry operate on two entirely different levels.
Mm-hmm.
Your conscious mind knows it's a book, but as we discussed with the fMRI study, your temporoparietal junction is receiving actual longing cues from the text.
Okay, I see.
You have fused with the avatar through first-person narration. You have bonded with a fictional partner through repeated intimate exposure. Your brain has established a secure base. So when you turn the final page and the story ends, that secure base is suddenly gone. The brain registers the sudden absence of a primary social bond.
It's mourning the loss of the connection.
Exactly. There was a fascinating study done on the series finale of the television show Friends. Researchers wanted to understand why viewers were so distraught. They found that the strength of the parasocial bond a viewer had formed with the characters was the single best predictor of how much grief they experienced when the show ended.
Oh, wow.
The distress resembles the dissolution of a real relationship because, as far as your social circuitry is concerned, a relationship has ended.
Which brings us to the core of the engine, stage four. Here's where it gets really interesting. The neurochemical loop.
This is the chemical payload.
Right. We have the scaffolding delaying the reward. We have the first person socket plugging the reader into the experience. We have the parasocial bond making the connection feel entirely real to the brain. Now, the engine closes the vault door and locks the reader inside. And it does this using two specific neurochemicals, dopamine and oxytocin.
Everything we've talked about is designed to deliver this payload, Let's start with dopamine, because it is probably the most misunderstood piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, people just think it means happiness.
Right. Popular culture often labels dopamine as the pleasure chemical, like the reward itself. Mm. People think of it as the feeling of satisfaction. But the foundational neurological work by Wolfram Scholz established that dopamine neurons primarily fire during the prediction of a reward, not the receipt of it.
They fire during the anticipation, the chase.
Yes. If a monkey learns that a flashing light means a drop of juice is coming in 10 seconds, the dopamine spike doesn't happen when the juice hits its tongue. The dopamine spike happens the moment the light flashes.
That completely flips it.
It does. As a cue becomes a reliable predictor of a reward, the dopamine signal shifts forward in time onto the cue itself. Kent Berridge's research further clarifies this by separating the brain's reward system into two distinct pathways, wanting and liking.
Okay, wanting and liking.
Dopamine mediates the motivational craving for a reward, the wanting phase. It creates the itch.
So let's map that back to the romance novel, a genre that is structurally built on scaffolding, on constantly delaying the consummation, interrupting the kiss, dragging out the enemies to lovers tension, is a genre that is literally optimized for wanting.
It sustains a compulsive pursuit. The reader is held in a prolonged state of dopaminergic anticipation. And when you inject unpredictable cliffhangers into that system, like we discussed with the serialized apps demanding coin unlocks, it supercharges the effect.
Because you never know when it's going to happen.
Exactly. Research by David Zald shows that variable and unpredictable rewards produce a significantly greater release of dopamine in the striatum than predictable ones.
It's the slot machine effect again. You don't know exactly when the payout is coming, so your brain pumps out dopamine to keep you pulling the lever.
The unresolved tension activates the brain's prediction networks. And there is a psychological principle called the Zeigarnik effect, which dictates that humans remember uncompleted or interrupted tasks better than completed ones.
Oh, so that's why cliffhangers stick in your head so much.
Exactly. A cliffhanger creates an open loop that demands closure, holding the story vividly in working memory and driving the dopamine craving until the loop is closed.
Okay, so dopamine is the drip. It's the craving that keeps you turning the page at 2 a.m. But what about the second chemical? Oxytocin, you called that the anger.
Dopamine drives the pursuit, but oxytocin creates the enduring attachment. Polzak has conducted numerous experiments demonstrating that emotionally engaging narratives, stories that follow a classic dramatic arc and elicit empathy, cause a measurable release of oxytocin in the bloodstream.
And what exactly is oxytocin doing in the body in this context?
Well, oxytocin is frequently called the molecule of attachment, trust, and pair bonding. It is the chemical that facilitates maternal bonding after childbirth. It promotes prosocial behaviors and reduces fear and anxiety in social situations.
Okay.
In animal models, particularly the heavily studied prairie voles, oxytocin is the necessary mechanism for the formation of lifelong pair bonds.
Wait, prairie voles are the ones that mate for life, right?
They are. And if you block their oxytocin receptors, that pair bonding behavior disappears. Now, apply this to the immersion engine. A first-person, highly intimate narrative experienced over hundreds of pages supplies the precise emotional and social stimuli that this oxytocin system responds to.
So the reader is getting hit with both dopamine and oxytocin simultaneously.
That is the masterstroke of the engine. The genre is co-activating the dopamine novelty and craving circuit, driven by the plot scaffolding and the oxytocin bonding and attachment circuit, driven by the parasocial intimacy.
Which is pretty rare, right?
Incredibly rare. That pairing high-stakes dopaminergic novelty combined with deep oxytocinergic security is almost impossible to find in ordinary life. In real life, novelty usually involves risk and anxiety, while security usually involves routine and predictability.
Wow, so true.
The immersion engine delivers the neurochemical peaks of both simultaneously without any of the real-world friction. That is what gives the experience its singular compelling pull.
But the sources point out that this perfectly tuned system has a dark side. And it comes down to a concept called tolerance.
Yes. The brain is fundamentally an adaptive organ. It seeks homeostasis.
It tries to balance itself out.
Exactly. When it is repeatedly subjected to hyper-stimulating rewards, it recalibrates to protect itself. There is a pivotal study by Kuhn and Gallinat that looked at the frequent consumption of explicit sexual media and its effect on brain structure.
And what did they find?
They found that high-frequency consumption actually correlated with smaller gray matter volume in a region called the right striatum and weaker connectivity between the striatum and the prefrontal cortex.
Okay, unpack that for me. What does a smaller right striatum actually mean for the reader's daily experience?
Well, the striatum is a critical component of the brain's reward system. What the researchers observed is evidence of the reward system downregulating against the chronic overstimulation. Think of it like walking into a room with blindingly bright lights. Your pupils constrict to let less light in so you aren't blinded. Yeah. At a neurochemical level, chronic exposure to massive dopamine spikes causes the brain to reduce the number of active striatal D2 dopamine receptors.
The brain literally boards up the window so the dopamine can't get in.
Exactly. This downregulation is the physiological substrate of tolerance. It means that the exact same stimulus that used to give you a massive thrill now barely registers. The baseline has shifted.
Which perfectly explains the behavioral signature of the entire romance market over the last few years. I mean, we've seen this massive shift toward what the industry calls dark romance.
Yes, the escalation.
Readers build a tolerance to the standard tropes. The sweet small-town romance doesn't trigger the dopamine release anymore because their receptors have downregulated. So they need higher heat levels, they need darker, more taboo tropes.
They need faster serialization.
Right, and more intense cliffhangers.
Right.
They need constant narrative escalation just to achieve the exact same chemical high they used to get from a basic paper romance novel. The industry is pushing darker and faster because the collective dopamine receptors of the readership are demanding a stronger dose.
That is the closed loop of the printed immersion engine. Craving, immersion, attachment, tolerance, and the demand for escalation.
Okay. I want you, the listener, to take a mental breath here because we are about to make a massive pivot. Everything we have discussed so far, the scaffolding, the first-person erasure, the parasocial bonding, and the dopamine-oxytocin loop, all of that is happening silently.
Yes, it is a four-stage machine running purely on ink on a page or text on a screen.
It requires the reader to actively translate visual symbols into an emotional experience.
Right. It takes cognitive effort.
But the second document in our sources explores what happens when you take the silent machine and you plug it into the booming $2.2 billion audiobook industry.
And the thesis here is that audio doesn't just add a fun new dimension or a fifth stage. Audio acts as a massive amplifier.
It takes the volume of all four of those existing stages and turns them up to 11 simultaneously.
It makes the metaphorical concepts we've been discussing literal. In the printed text, the publishers use voice as a grammatical concept.
Mm.
You know, the first person I. The audiobook removes the metaphor and supplies an actual vibrating human voice.
And the tech industry is racing to capitalize on this. We are seeing platforms explicitly built for auditory romance and erotica. There's Dipsy, which is a massively popular app built around short-form audio stories, primarily for women.
And Quinn, too.
Yeah, Quinn. An app that uses recognizable celebrity voices to narrate explicit scenarios. There's even hardware integration now, like the company Lovin's pairing their teledildonic sex toys with audio platforms like Audio Desires to create multi-sensory feedback loops synced to the narrator's voice.
The co-founder of Dipsy gave an interview where she called their audio stories the blueprint for you to fill in with whatever bodies, faces, and settings you like.
It is the blank slate protagonist concept, but weaponized with high-definition audio.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Let's break down exactly how audio amplifies the first two stages of the engine, the timing and the distance.
Yeah.
Think about stage one, the scaffolding and the delay of reward.
Okay.
In a printed book, the reader still maintains ultimate control over the pace. If the anticipation becomes too frustrating, or if the author spends three pages describing a ballroom when you just want to get to the dialogue, you can skim.
You can cheat the slot machine. You can flip ahead to see if they kiss at the end of the chapter.
Precisely. But in an audiobook, you surrender control of the tempo to the narrator.
Oh, wow. You can't skim audio the same way.
The vocal performance physically prevents you from skimming. It forces you to sit in that dopamine-rich anticipatory phase for exactly as long as the producer wants you to. A skilled narrator will slow their cadence, insert deliberate pauses, and draw out the tension, maximizing the dopaminergic wanting phase in a way a static page just cannot enforce.
And then there is the delivery mechanism itself. We aren't listening to these stories on a boombox across the room. We are listening to them on AirPods. We are using headphones.
Which introduces a critical psychological phenomenon. The forces point to a major study by Lieberman and colleagues on the effect of headphones. They conducted 5 different experiments with over 4,000 participants.
That's a massive sample size.
It is. They found that listening through headphones produces a phenomenon known as in-head localization.
In-head localization, meaning your brain perceives the sound as originating from inside your own skull.
Yes. When you hear a voice through an external speaker, Your brain triangulates the sound waves interacting with the room and understands the speaker is far away.
Right, there's spatial distance.
But headphones bypass that acoustic environment. The voice is localized directly between your ears. Lieberman's study found that this specific acoustic delivery tricks the brain into perceiving the communicator as physically and socially closer, and therefore significantly warmer and more intimate than if you heard the exact same recording from a speaker on a desk.
So the voice narrating this highly explicit, parasocially bonded romance isn't just in the room with you. It is quite literally localized inside your head. It is sitting at the exact acoustic distance of a whisper against your ear.
And this forced intimacy leads to a fascinating physiological paradox.
Yeah.
There was a study conducted at University College London, led by Joseph Devlin, that perfectly illustrates the hidden power of audio.
Oh, I read about this in the sources.
They took matched scenes from popular media, a scene from Game of Thrones, for example, and had participants either watch the video version or listen to the audiobook version.
Okay, and what did they find? Because intuitively, you'd think the visual version with millions of dollars in CGI and actors would be way more engaging.
That is exactly what the participants thought. When surveyed, the users reported feeling significantly less consciously engaged by the audio than by the video. But the biometric sensors told a completely different story.
The body didn't lie.
No, it didn't. The audio versions produced a significantly stronger physiological reaction across the board. Higher heart rates, greater skin conductance, and higher body temperatures.
Wait, I want to make sure I understand this. Their conscious minds reported that they were bored or less engaged by the audiobook, but their autonomic nervous systems were firing on all cylinders. Why the disconnect?
Because of the cognitive effort required by the medium. Video is a passive intake medium. All the visual information is provided for you. But audio is an active co-creation. Your brain has to actively synthesize the visual imagery based on the auditory cues.
So you're building the world in your head.
Yes. This imaginative reconstruction requires deep cognitive processing that bypasses your conscious, critical defenses. The gap between the low perceived engagement and the high measured bodily arousal is the classic signature of a stimulus working below the threshold of conscious notice. The body is reacting to the synthesized imagery as if it were a real physical threat or a real physical arousal.
Man, I love the analogy we used earlier about the blueprint. If the printed book is a detailed blueprint that you have to actively read and interpret, the performed audiobook is like strapping on a VR headset.
That's exactly it.
You don't just imagine the room. The narrator constructs the room around you and locks you inside it. And your body, your heart rate, your skin temperature reacts as if you are physically standing in that room.
What's truly fascinating, and what brings us to section 6 of the outline, is why the human voice possesses this privileged access to our autonomic nervous system.
Yeah, why is voice so different?
Well, the human brain does not treat a human voice like it treats other acoustic data.
Right. Hearing someone whisper your name is fundamentally different from hearing a car horn or a dog barking.
Entirely different. Pascal Bilien's research highlights a specific region of the brain called the temporal voice areas, located in the superior temporal cortex. When you read text on a page, the visual language networks have to decode the symbols. But a human voice selectively triggers this dedicated evolutionary machinery.
Evolutionary machinery, so it's primal.
Highly primal. From a single spoken syllable, the temporal voice areas instantly extract a wealth of data. The speaker's identity, their sex, their approximate physical size, and their emotional state.
It's a survival mechanism. You need to know instantly if the person grunting in the dark cave with you is angry or happy.
Exactly. And because it's a survival mechanism, this machinery has what you might call a VIP pass to the brain's emotional centers.
A VIP pass. I like that.
Abrams' research shows that this voice selective cortex has direct functional connectivity to the core reward circuitry, the nucleus accumbens, the ventral tegmental area, and the amygdala.
Oh, wow.
A printed page does not have a direct hardwired neural backdoor to these emotional and reward centers. It has to route through cognitive interpretation. But a human voice bypasses the interpreter and goes straight to the reward center.
And the payload that travels through that back door is what the source is referred to as emotional prosody.
Yes. Emotional prosody encompasses everything beyond the actual words. The pitch, the rhythm, the timbre, the breathiness of the delivery. Think about the difference between reading text and hearing audio. In a book, you read the words, "He sighed heavily."
Okay.
Your brain has to decode the word "sigh," access the memory of what a sigh means, and then translate that into an empathetic feeling. But in an audiobook, you don't read about a sigh. You physically hear a real human catch their breath and exhale.
The emotional contagion is direct and visceral. You feel the exhale in your own chest.
Which perfectly explains a major trend in the audiobook industry right now. Audible producers have noted that duet narration, which is where a male and female actor perform a scene together simultaneously, mm-hmm. almost like a radio play, instead of one narrator doing all the voices, is becoming the massively popular new standard.
And they know exactly why it's popular, don't they?
Oh, they do. The producers explicitly state why, because you can hear their breath. A printed scene, no matter how well written, cannot breathe. A performed one can.
When I was reading about the intimacy of the breath and the close mic recording, it immediately made me think of ASMR. Is this the exact same neurological mechanism driving the ASMR phenomenon on YouTube and TikTok? Because it sounds incredibly similar.
It is the exact same mechanism harnessed for narrative. Research on ASMR, autonomous sensory meridian response, shows that close mic whispering, crisp phonetic sounds, and direct auditory address produce a profound sense of non-reciprocal intimacy at a distance.
Non-reciprocal intimacy.
It creates a deeply felt physical and emotional closeness with a speaker who is not actually there and who never responds to you. Physiologically, ASMR triggers have been shown to significantly lower heart rates, reduce cortisol levels, and activate the parasympathetic nervous system, which is responsible for calming and soothing the body.
Okay, so now take all of that data and put it together. Imagine taking that ASMR intimacy, that physical tingling closeness that lowers your defenses and makes you feel incredibly safe, and attaching it to a 10-hour, perfectly paced, explicit romanticy arc designed to spike your dopamine.
That is exactly how audio supercharges stage 3 and stage 4 of our engine. It creates what we can call the double bond and the neurochemical overdrive.
Let's talk about the double bond first. Because introducing a real human voice completely fractures the parasocial relationship we talked about earlier. You aren't just bonding with the fictional avatar of the book boyfriend anymore.
No, you bond with the character, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But you simultaneously bond with the actual living human narrator whose voice is vibrating inside your skull.
Right.
The listener is inviting this performer's voice into their head, into their most intimate imagined scenarios for dozens of hours at a time. The sources highlight how intense the secondary bond becomes.
Yeah.
They mention Anthony Palmini, who became this massive real-world romanticy heartthrob entirely based on his voice work for NPR and various audiobooks.
The sources mention that listeners will literally hunt down a narrator's pseudonyms because narrators often use fake names when doing explicit books. The fans will play detective just so they can follow that specific voice across different series, completely regardless of who the author is or what the plot is.
The fictional relationship gains a real-world, audible target that the listener can seek out on demand. They are addicted to the voice itself.
And that addiction is driven by the neurochemical overdrive. Let's look at the dopamine and oxytocin loop again, but this time through the lens of audio. We know dopamine is about anticipation.
Yes. Salimpour conducted a landmark PET scan study looking at how the brain responds to music and audio anticipation. They demonstrated that auditory anticipation releases dopamine in two distinct anatomical phases.
Two phases? How does that work?
During the buildup, the anticipatory phase, where the music is swelling or the narrator is slowing their pace as the characters get closer, dopamine is released in the caudate nucleus.
Here.
But at the actual peak of the experience, the climax of the scene, the dopamine release shifts to the nucleus accumbens, which is the core pleasure center.
So a skilled narrator manipulating the tempo of an explicit scene is quite literally milking both phases of the dopamine system.
Exactly. They are stretching the caudate release and maximizing the nucleus accumbens payoff.
And the oxytocin. We know the story's emotional arc releases it, but what about the sound of the voice itself?
This is perhaps the most profound finding in the entire physiological literature on this topic. Seltzer, Ziegler, and Pollack conducted a study looking at oxytocin release in stressed children.
Okay.
They subjected girls to a stressful task to raise their cortisol levels. Then they divided them into three groups. One group was comforted by their mothers in person with physical touch. One group only heard their mother's voice over a phone. And a control group watched a film with no contact.
And what happened?
The girls who received physical touch saw a rapid drop in cortisol and a massive spike in oxytocin, as expected. But the girls who only heard their mother's voice over the phone experienced the exact same rapid spike in oxytocin. Their levels were statistically indistinguishable from the group that received full physical touch.
Wow. Just the sound of the voice alone triggers the exact same bonding chemical as a physical embrace.
Yes. The acoustic voice itself carries the molecule of attachment. The acoustic properties of a comforting, intimate human voice are a direct biological key to the oxytocin vault. What's fascinating here is how this completely transforms the reading experience.
If we pull all of this together and connect it to the bigger picture, the sheer efficiency of the audiobook is staggering. Mm. The printed book is powerful, but it asks your brain to do a lot of heavy lifting. It asks you to consciously generate a voice in your head, to translate symbols into emotions in order to release these chemicals.
It takes work.
But the audiobook bypasses all of that cognitive effort. It simply injects the intimate human voice and the subsequent massive doses of dopamine and oxytocin directly into your ear canal.
It is a frictionless delivery system for the exact neurochemical states that human beings crave most: excitement and secure attachment.
We have taken a massive journey today. We started by peeling back the curtain on the publishing industry and realizing that the plot of these massive romantasy bestsellers isn't really a story at all. It's a carefully engineered structural scaffolding designed specifically to delay reward.
Yep, the slot machine.
We saw how the combination of first-person present tense grammar and a blank slate protagonist completely erases the psychological distance between you and the page. We explored the temporoparietal junction and how that repeated intimacy creates a parasocial bond that your brain literally processes as a real human relationship.
The secure base.
Exactly. We tracked the neurochemical loop, locking the reader in the dopamine drip of the chase and the oxytocin anchor of the attachment, leading to tolerance and the demand for darker, faster tropes.
And finally, we saw how plugging that exact four-stage silent machine into a pair of headphones with a professional actor whispering into your temporal voice areas turns the entire system into neurochemical overdrive, fracturing the bond between the character and the narrator.
It is a brilliantly designed, flawlessly executed immersion engine. It explains the 51 million books. It explains the $610 million in revenue. But I want to leave you, the listener, with a final thought to mull over as you go about your day, something that builds on everything we've unpacked today.
Mm-hmm.
We have seen how perfectly the system runs when a human author and a human narrator engineer it for a mass audience. But think about the trajectory of technology. Think about the very near future.
Oh, yeah.
What happens to our brains and to our real-world relationships when this exact same four-stage immersion engine is hooked up to a generative AI? We are talking about an intelligence that can generate a hyper-personalized, dynamically shifting story and a synthesized, perfectly prosodic voice reacting in real time to your specific biometric feedback.
It's not that far off.
No, it isn't. Mm. If a static, pre-recorded audiobook can hack our oxytocin, bypass our conscious defenses, and make us grieve a fake relationship like it was a real breakup,
right?
What happens when the immersion engine starts reading us back?
It suggests we are moving from a model of mass-produced parasocial attachment to bespoke, algorithmic intimacy. And the neurological implications of that are profound.
It really makes you look at the app on your phone differently. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the machinery, and we will see you next time.